Welcome, episode 39, podcast.
Yep.
All right, what have we got to look forward to in this episode today,
Len? Well, this was sort of initiated by you. It's a guy called Richard Parry. He is now a solicitor. I think he's somebody, we don't get to talk to him that much about who he was, really. He's somebody who's clearly been embedded in the anarchist kind of left-wing movement all his life.
Mm-hmm.
He's now a solicitor representing, for example, people in the Spy Cops scandal. But about 20-odd years ago, he wrote a book called The Bono Gang, which is about a group of anarchist bank robbers, basically, who, amongst other things, invented the getaway car, the first use of the getaway car in a bank robbery. But it's also about their political... It's a kind of fairly free-ranging interview, I think. But it's essentially about, you know, it's an idea of, you know, we've been interested in exploring ideas of anarchism. What the Bono Gang were part of a pan-European movement of what was often referred to as illegalists. So they're people who say, essentially, I think, that rather than forming trying to found an anarchist society as the anarcho-syndicalists wanted to do, and then have a society that had no rules or very few rules, instead you start living your life as if there are no rules right now. And that inevitably leads to criminality. I think that led them down the road of robbing banks and doing wage heists and stuff like that. Hmm. They're interesting
and
because
murdering.
I'm murdering people, yeah.
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, if they got in their way.
Yeah.
But also what you see with these people is the prototypes in many ways of the world that we live in now, that they were generally vegetarians.
Yeah.
That they didn't believe in marriage, that they had very kind of fluid sexual relations.
Health conscious.
They're very health conscious. Yeah, they were very keen on cycling.
Yeah, no drinking alcohol.
And had this system of kind of Swedish exercise that they mm-hmm. into. So really, really interesting kind of forerunners of kind of philosophical and political ideas that obviously are now in many ways in the mainstream of our society. So it's I just thought he was a really interesting guy. I'd like to talk to him again. Really, a guy that's had a great deal of personal experience, I think, of the left, and also extraordinarily well read. I think it. You know, again, at one point he said, you know, of course, Bakunin said, and he said to me, you know, you've read Bakunin. I said, you know, look, you've got to understand about me that this is all fake. You know, my knowledge of my reading is extremely patchy. I mean, there's some shit that...
A nice little rally of you guys listing your favorite anarchists one by one. You went back and forth a few times. That was impressive.
But I am not somebody like him who is extraordinarily well read. I am very well read in certain very narrow areas, really. But it also slid into our other favorite topic, my other favorite topic, which is firearms.
Yes.
So where are you going to get that? A mixture of anarchism and talk about John Browning's design for the 1910 9mm FN pistol.
And the Browning, and but not as much car talk as I would have expected, because I know that's another one of your...
No, cars of that era don't really interest me, really. It's only later when I, sort of early, the 1910s and 20s are not really my period. It's only when you get into
Fair
the...
Enough.
Pre-war and then post-war era of automobiles that get me interested.
Frustratingly, when we stopped recording, you guys went on to have a really fascinating conversation. You went on for another half hour.
Yeah.
And we were both kind of like, shit, we should have recorded that.
Yeah, maybe we should get him back. Yeah, see how it goes, this one. But he is a fascinating character, I think.
It was good. And I was very... When it's on me to organise the guest, it's always a lot of pressure. And I'm very glad it went well.
Let's get into it. Alexis L, Richard Parry, and the story of the Bono Gang.
Mm-hmm.
way off. What podcast number is this, Talal?
Morning, Alexi. This morning. Is episode 39, I believe.
Episode 39. And this is your initiation, really. So you want to tell us what this is about? You've been angling for this for a while.
Actually, correction, this is episode 40.
Oh, episode 40. Yeah. It's really important. It's so important that we get it right. That really it's the, you know.
So, a couple of years ago, I came across this book about the Bonnet Gang. I've been calling it the Bonnet Gang for
Bono.
Years. But now I know it's called the Bono Gang. And it is episode 39. Episode 39. Yeah, I came across this book by...
So many people's world is tilted now. They thought it was episode 40, and then turns out to be episode 39. It's like finding that your father was, in the SS.
Oh, right, yeah.
Actually, I know somebody's father.
Do you?
Yeah, we'll do that.
Okay. So I came across this book and... about anarchists in early 1900s France.
Yes.
And it caught my eye because I like the idea of anarchy as sort of like a utopian society, a way of running a community that doesn't require law or government.
Yeah, these people weren't anything to do with that, really.
And this book was not really that kind of anarchy, but it was still a thrilling read. And it's written by Richard Parry.
Okay.
And I wanted you to read it because I thought it would align with a lot of your kind of, a lot of the topics you talk about. And it's really also, it's just, there's a lot of guns and cars in there.
Well, yeah, that's one of the early days. That's one of the areas we should talk about. So anyway, we have the author of the Bono Gang here, Richard Parry. And just, I don't know, tell us about who they were, what they were. I mean, well, I'll summarize in a sense. So it's in two parts, really. There is a kind of, There is a kind of separate chapters about the leading anarchists in not just in France, but in, because obviously anarchism had, you know, very strong links with, particularly with Russia and elsewhere. So there's the various influences, the stuff about, there's also interestingly enough, there's also Tom Wyman, the philosophy lecturer, who actually wrote a bit that I do called the poem that I do on stage and on the radio called "I Hate Keir Starmer," which I don't credit him enough. But Tom, anyway, he wrote a book about Marx and Engels, the German ideology, which is an attack on Stirner, who's one of the kind of the fountainheads of this kind of movement. He was writing in the 19th century, and Marx and Engels felt it behove them to attack him at great length, really, because it's about the foundations of a certain type of anarchism. I mean, in a way, it shouldn't be called anarchism, because I think the kind of anarchism that I vaguely imagine is a kind of small units, kind of very democratic, people, lots of communal living, like the guy, you know, talking about Rojava, you know.
Yeah.
Endless bloody meetings, sounds fucking terrible in many ways, but, a kind of democratic side. These people, the illegalists and their antecedents were not that. So, I don't know, let's start there, I guess. Or start wherever you want, really.
Or whatever.
Okay. So, the Bono Gang story is a story of people who called themselves illegalists. They later became the Bono Gang because one of the newspapers at the time decided that Bono was the main character. He was the one who assassinated the deputy chief of police in Paris. He was the one who, first one to get killed in a massive police shootout that really is the Siege of Sydney Street. Sort of,
well, because we have our own, our own equivalent to that, which was Siege of Sydney Street.
And which is absolutely contemporary as well.
Yeah. And famous footage of
Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill as the Home Secretary showboating with the police, in the police with the. And the other thing that we should talk about as well is there's a fair amount, because this it intersects with this podcast, because one of our subjects is anarchy, the other subject is firearms, of course. Oh. And so there is, you talk a lot about the Browning 1910 9mm pistol, and also you talk about the Winchester rifles that you sell. You don't, I'm afraid, and this is a major critique, comrade, you don't say what calibre the Winchesters are. I assume they're probably 45s.
I'm not entirely sure of that. But they were actually stolen to order by some other anarchists.
Yeah, yeah. So, but there is this amazing, you talk about the like the playwright Alfred Jerry, you know, wrote Peru, so yeah. Had used to carry two. It was a fashion item. Yeah. The 9mm 1910 Browning semi-automatic pistol was a fashion, and he gave one to Picasso. So like, so everybody was packing in those, yeah. You know, in them bars in Montparnasse, you know, Closerie right. de Lilas. Yeah. Everybody's got like a nine. It's yeah. like yeah. it's like West Baltimore. Well,
no, but it's true. Packing iron. And yeah. the police would arrive at one of these working class sort of balls, as they call them, just a sort of evening dance.
Yeah.
And they would surround the place, and then they would just go through everybody's pockets, and then all the people with 9mm, they'd arrest and charge with illegal possession of firearms.
Yeah.
And that was one of the criticisms of people carrying these weapons. In fact, they didn't actually use them. They were just being used as fashion accessories, and then they'd end up in jail for 3 months
That's
for it.
So weird.
But yeah, it was very widespread.
Yeah, and we could maybe do it. Yeah, I mean, the 9mm is designed by Browning, but made by FN Fabrique Nationale
in Belgium.
Hairstyle in Belgium, yes. Yeah. A manufacturer of many.
Because it was lightweight. Yeah. You could conceal it very easily, and you could get, I think some of them came with up to 15 rounds in.
It'd have to be an extended magazine. But
extended magazine. Seven, I think.
Alexei, yeah. You haven't let Richard finish telling us who the Bonner Gang are.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Look, I suppose...
Get back to guns in a minute.
The way for people to think about it is, you know, what are the sort of, these sort of great cops and robbers stories that people think about? You've got Bonnie and Clyde in America, but that's much later, you know, that's 15 years plus later. And this is like Bonnie and Clyde on steroids, plus with the politics.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Siege of Sydney Street. Well, in this story, you get two sieges, you know, that are massive. There's 20,000 people go and watch this. There's machine guns. They try and bring out the artillery. There's dynamite used against them. There's a massive gun battle. Loads of people get injured by flying bullets. And it's a real event. And then it's also filmed, because this is the start of the modern era, and it's on the cinemas in Paris. They're actually running the newsreels.
No.
And there are people just shouting out, we want to see Bono, we want to see Bono. And he becomes like the great working class anti-hero of the time. And
because one of the also one of the strange things in your book, which is really interesting, I think, again, it's gone on to political ideology, is that when somebody committed a crime, large crowds would chase them, which I don't think happens now. And there's always a pursuing crowd of, and like at one point they shoot like a 10-year-old. They shoot like 22 people who are pursuing them in a mob. You know?
That is the story of prior to the Siege of Sydney Street, the same gang who were Latvian anarchists in London. They'd tried to rob a factory in Tottenham, and they were the ones who were pursued across the Tottenham marshes. And they were just shooting, you know, whoever was chasing them. And that's the story you're thinking of. And, of course, that incident was defended by the great revolutionary Victor Serge when he was an anarchist. And he was right. He was part of this illegalist group.
And he refers to it as Tottingham as well. Yes. Just like Ozzy Ardiles.
Les anarchistes de Tottingham. That's right. And he defends all that, saying, you know, we're rebels. We're not going to submit to authority and all that. But I think you started off asking about anarchism and whether these people are anarchists or, you know, where their politics comes from. And, well, they are anarchists, but what they're not is they're not syndicalists. So at the time, the biggest proportion of anarchists were effectively anarcho-syndicalists.
Without and describe what syndicalism is. For those of us who don't know,
who thought that workers needed to be organised in unions, that the state would be overthrown through a mass strike, effectively like Rosa Luxemburg later thought would be a way forward, but without a sort of political seizing of power, that the working class would take power through their unions.
This is very strong in the United States, of course, the Wobblies, the IWW.
Yeah, exactly like that. And of course, in Spain, it became massive. And in France, it was very strong as well. But these anarchists, they came really from anarcho-communism, which was like anarchists in communes. And then they even rejected that and became individualists. And the individualist current was very strong. And in a way, this is a whole precursor to that explosion in 68, where you have the whole concept that the personal is the political. And although the Bono gang did not appear to leave any legacy, because they got shot, they got executed, the people around them and what they were doing actually really prefigured the 60s in quite a large way. They're vegetarians.
Yeah.
They believe in exercising, looking after your body, not eating too much salt, not drinking alcohol, going cycling to get exercise. They've got these new Swedish exercises. Some of them are into naturism.
And that's one of the most shocking parts of the book, is that I think there were bits where you were describing them hanging out in the back garden, like listening to jazz and doing exercise. And
then somebody's shooting their 9mm at the target, and then somebody walking around naked.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
having huge arguments over what's in the food, you know, yeah. that somebody put too much salt in or something. It's hilarious in yeah. a way.
They also seem, several of them seem to have, of the men seem to have pairs of female lovers, both who were often sisters who were school teachers as well.
Well, there's one particular character who was, they said, was the prime mover of anarchist individualism in Paris, called Albert Libertad. And he actually had, I think he'd had childhood polio, so he had two crutches yeah. that apparently he used to fight with the police with them. But he had two lovers who were both sisters.
Mm.
And when he died, when I was in Paris, I found a secret police report on his death that did not appear in the papers of the anarchist newspapers, which said that the truth of his death was that he had an argument with the sisters and one of them kicked him in the stomach.
Right, yeah.
And he died. But, of course, the anarchist press actually referred to him dying in a fight with the police or something. But, I mean, he was a real character. There's some great photos of him, you know, when he's the pictures of them all together in the anarchist picnics, and they'd all go cycling down to the Marne and go in the water. In fact, sometimes I believe they went to beaches. They would liberate a beach, as they said, take all their clothes off, which, right. of course, this is the Edwardian era when everybody's covered up, you know.
Yeah.
And they would rip all their clothes off and go, you know, we've liberated the beach.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
this is the cute side of these people. They are also murderous killers, aren't they, of well, innocent civilians or not? I mean, discuss. Really.
Yes. Well, so, but what happens is that they believe in illegalism, they don't believe in the law, they're also, and part of this is, the one of the principal things at this time is we are moving towards World War One. Everybody thought the war was going to happen in 1912, it didn't, there was a crisis in Morocco, and the French extended the conscription law to 3 years, and it was the anarchists who said, you must refuse to serve, get false documents. Mm-hmm. By 1913, the anarchists had taken 30,000 men out of the French army, which is quite an achievement.
Yeah.
And the socialist position was, oh, no, you must do your military service.
Yes.
But, you know, when it comes, you must, you know, there must be no war. We'll all go on strike. And, of course, we know what, in fact, happened. They all went to war.
Yes, I mean, that was a really interesting and, you know, has obviously a lot of contemporary echoes in that. Yes, all the most, you know, left wingers all very meekly joined in with the militarism of the First World War. You know, and you can see that in Labour's, for instance, uncritical admiration for NATO.
And it's interesting to think that the first use of those machine guns is against Bono in his hideout. You know, they've got the machine guns rattling away.
Maxim.
Not the Gatling guns. Yeah,
no, Maxim.
The Maxim.
I assume it's a Maxim.
And it's interesting to speculate, had these people not engaged in this activity, what would have been their position when it came to being called up for the war? Because some people think, well, they were just Mako, they liked guns, they liked shooting, you know, they'd have joined in the war. But in fact, they were the ones who resisted. They were the ones who had false papers. They refused to join the army. They were the ones who said, we'd rather shoot first and we don't care what's going to happen. You've asked about, of course, they killed people or innocent people, of course, when they robbed banks, they shot a number of people completely gratuitously, as far as I can see. There's no justification for it. This was a huge criticism by, you know, almost the entire anarchist movement, as well as everybody else. And it all ended disastrously. They in particular, one of the young guys involved, and some of these people are like 21 years old, they took the view that the rest of the workers were slaves for putting up with the state of society. Mm. And you have to remember that this society was viciously, you know, it was capitalist in terms that we're only now rediscovering.
Yeah.
As the accumulation of wealth back then is now, in fact, as it is now, isn't it?
Yeah.
The rate of accumulation.
And of course, one of their arguments against syndicalists and trade unions, I was discussing this with Linda last night, because she always said, that a lot of the great advances of capitalist society were actually made by the British working class and by the unions, you know, education, you know, healthcare, all that. But then on the other hand, those anarchists would say all that did was make capitalism slightly less intolerable, and slightly more efficient.
Well, in a way, yes, it sort of fixed capitalism within the consciousness of the working class and therefore made them less prone to revolution.
Mm.
And in a sense, that's right. But then you had all those real achievements. But once they're taken away from your own agency, so once the state adopts them, you then let it slide and you forget there's a historical sort of lack of memory that all those things were won through working class struggle. And then suddenly you get to an era where they're just taken away one by one because nobody knows how to fight for them anymore.
Right, right.
And that's where we are now, isn't it?
Absolutely, but yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's another conversation.
Well, no, it's all, I mean, this is a very free-flowing discussion, I think. I hope the listener finds it. We're not... Tala, as a representative of the listener.
Representing the listener, I find that when I was reading the book, and I do recommend the book to the listeners to go and get it. What's the full title? The Bono Gang?
The Bono Gang, the story of the French legalists.
And it's got really nice, really lots of very cool pictures in there. And so you really do get immersed into the situation and the story, and there's nice profiles and all the characters involved. But I did find myself creating threads and connections between then and now, like you're doing now, that naturally occurs as you talk about it, how similar the situation is now and how much we need some bastards like this in our streets.
Well, because what the classic Marxist analysis of the criminal classes, because what we're also talking about here is a very strong juncture, obviously, between politics and just criminal, really, that Marx and Engels would refer to the criminals as the lumpen proletariat. Yeah. And their notion was that they were parasitic on the working class, whereas presumably the illegalists, I mean, the illegalists kind of swam in the underworld, really, in a sense, part of the underworld. It's a kind of interesting,
I'm not sure that's true.
Isn't it?
I think there was something different about these people. That the underworld was something quite different.
But they did underworld things. They stole shit.
They did, but they would see themselves as separate because they had a political ideology behind it, whereas the normal working class criminals would just be there to accumulate their own cash. But of course, other anarchists would say, but you're doing exactly the same thing as you've just said. And they'd say, well, no, we're doing it consciously because we have a certain consciousness of our position in society. And therefore... Yeah. They've sort of ideologized it.
Yeah.
But of course, the net effect is exactly what happens. They end up shooting working class bank clerks who are just working behind the counter in a bank.
Yeah.
And so it does lead it leads nowhere, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's the problem. Politically, it was a dead end. But the point, and one of the reasons I wanted to write this story is because you only ever read this story, and I should say that this is the only book in English. Certainly when I wrote it was the first book in English. I think somebody's written something since.
Mm-hmm.
But the story is very well known in France, but it's always written from a police perspective.
Right.
Always from the police perspective. Even now, if you look on what's the latest series, Paris Police 1900. So that's following through exactly the contemporaneous sort of police officers of the time. But this, my book, is to go inside the minds and inside the world of the anarchists and look at it from their perspective. They come from a working class background. They're all solidly working class. And you can't really take that away from them. You can't just call them petty bourgeois or lumpen proletarians. I mean, they're just part of the working class. And at this period, the oppression of the working class is extreme. The poverty and the working conditions are so bad that it's not surprising that people did opt for criminal options. And that's so. But when Bono comes to Paris, he's in his 30s.
I keep thinking the lead singer of U2.
Yeah.
No. I mean, if the French police had turned the machine guns on Bono, or you know, two thumbs up for that, really. If they surrounded, tracked down Bono and possibly the Edge.
They were living on the Edge.
Yeah.
But he turns up and he meets these youngsters, effectively, in Paris. Mm. And that's how they form a gang. He's, you know, he's older. He knows how to drive. And, of course, these people, they're the very first people to use the car in a getaway as an arm. They actually set the tone for how to do an effective armed robbery. You know, you take a car. The police didn't have cars. They had to form a special brigade with motor vehicles to chase them. Right. Because before that, there were cops on bicycles going, stop!
Horses,
or on horses. You know?
Yeah.
As the Bonner gang are sort of smashing their way through the barrier on the outskirts of Paris and racing off to Chantilly, robbing a bank and then racing back. Bono is the man. He's the driver. He knows how to fix cars. He knows how to steal cars, how to start them and how to drive. And so he's admired for that. And then the others just throw their lot in with him, and then that's what kicks it all off. So they effectively sort of terrorise Paris and this whole region for months on end until they're finally cornered and shot in a massive siege, two massive sieges.
I mean, just to go back a little, what your book also evokes, though, is this extraordinary foment of study, a working class study, you know, of working class people reading, voracious reading and discussing, for our terms of reference, all left ideologies. This amazing, you know, that you know, when socialist texts came out, you know, working class men would run down and buy them, and then they would have these discussions above pubs or these social events. You know, this tremendous foment of ordinary working class people, trying to figure out a different way of living, really, and and then I'd like to think that's happening somewhere now, but I suspect it isn't really. I don't know.
I don't think it's really happening on TikTok at the moment.
Talal, what are the kids doing?
You know what? I'm not a kid, but you know, you reminded me earlier of the Woodcraft folk. We've talked about them before.
Paramilitary wing of the co-op.
That's what you say, but. Yeah. You were saying, like, of all these lefties and socialists, none of them actually refused to go and join the army in World War One. But that's how Woodcraft folk formed, is people in the UK who refused...
Conscientious objectors.
Conscientious objectors. They went and hid in the woods and camped out.
Oh, really?
And that's why Woodcraft folk is all about camping and woodcraft, you know, building fires, survival and stuff, because they went and lived in the woods while World War One was kicking off. They're like, we're not getting involved. They went and camped out in the woods.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so if you go to Woodcraft folk camps today, and there's the big international camps that happen every year or every couple of years where sister organisations around the world all come together and they have big seminars, they get together.
They're like, is there a link between like MAGA survivalists and
Woodcraft folk?
No, living in the woods.
It's very strictly lefty, socialist. Right. And that's where I first learned about anarchy, because we would sit around and discuss political ideas, the difference between Marxism and Trotskyism, and what could work in today's society. And anarchy, my very good friend taught me about anarchy and like, I won't name him because he would go out and do actions. He'd go out and do, things at night and make political statements in his way. But we would sit around in tents and little marquees. Someone would read out from a pamphlet to us, but nowhere else have I seen that. Well, you know what? Camberwell Arts School as well. That's full of lefties who love to talk about this shit, and they create zines about politics and...
Well, it's funny you mentioned the forest, though, because a lot of these guys, they did go to commune. In fact, Victor Serge, the very first thing he did was he leaves Brussels and they go to the commune in the forest. you know, just south of Brussels, a huge Forêt de Soignes, I think it's called, or Soigny. And that's where the first commune is. And some of these later people, after all this is over and done with, they form communes that are quite well known. In fact, one guy invents the salad, La Basconaise. You know, yeah, it's like he invents a salad that they still use today. I can't remember
what's in it.
Oh, a salad.
He said the salad.
No, yeah. A salad. You know, it's salad. Like a salad named after an illegalist. Yeah, right. In fact, I've got a picture of him right here. Louis Rambo. Yeah, I brought some nice little props, some little pictures of all these.
What's the name of the salad?
It's La Basconaise. Oh, so. Oh, there he is. That's him. So he's looking, you know, fairly regular, and he's got a collarless shirt because he hasn't got his collar on. He's just got a jacket and a waistcoat and quite a neat moustache, actually. He's looking, that's a very modern moustache.
Yeah.
And so that's I think, Louis Rambeau, and he invents this salad called La Basconaise, and he's part of a commune. There's a whole commune movement. Amongst these
probably
people.
Got
a hand, well.
He's probably got Semtex in it.
They're not sort of completely individualistic. There's a tension between living together in a commune and being individualist.
But we do very much see the, as you say, the foundation stones of the 60s and the world we live in today. I mean, we live in a world in a sense now. I mean, the politics has been stripped out of it, but we live in a world of extraordinary individualism because that suits the power, doesn't it, really? I think just make a huge leap.
Well, there's a difference between, I suppose...
Well, consumerist individualism.
The other thing I wanted to mention about...
Is this going... Is this weaving too... Is this too all over the place for you? Cause,
yeah, how you
I'm trying to bring it back. But we haven't mentioned the women involved.
Yes.
And so, you know, I'm not... The women didn't play a part in the robberies, but they were intimately connected, and they were, you know, in the hideouts with these guys as well. But one thing I wanted to mention was the anarchists at the time, the female anarchists at the time, were very active in the abortion movement and women's rights. And so, I mean, in America, you get Emma Goldman. That's one of the reasons she's persecuted. It's not for her revolutionarism. It's because of her stance on women's rights. Well, as you can see today, what's happening in America. And it's the anarchists are there at the very start of that sort of debate. So there's a lot of... one other thing I wanted to mention. Anti-colonialism. It's only the anarchists who say, you know, the colonies should be free.
Right.
The socialist position is they need to be properly governed.
Yes. I mean, that's such a parallel, because that's ultimately what did for Corbyn was not anything... His anti-colonial stance. That's what the power couldn't stand, I think. It can't accept. And that's what, I mean, Starmer is clearly very pro-colonial, you know. Yeah, sorry.
Well,
I keep interrupting. I'm sorry.
No, another debate. I don't mind.
Yeah.
What else? The women's roles in it were, they were often confidants, but also like big parts of hiding the men.
Yeah,
like
they'd be hiding the stuff, the secret. I mean, that's why Bono's lover, Judith, I mean, they were vicious against her when when they arrested her. You know, he was trying to say that she had nothing to do with it. But unfortunately, his stash of goods was hidden up her chimney, as it were. And they found it. And they sentenced her to 4 years and she died in prison. And that was quite nasty.
Yeah.
Another aspect that is worth
mentioning. Everybody's got TB in this story, haven't they, really?
Well, that wasn't just a working class killer, was it? TB was very extensive at the time.
Yeah.
And of course, that was one of the reasons that young Andre, what was he, 19 years old? He's got this massive rifle and he's shooting over people's heads outside the bank. But he knows he's going to die of TB.
Right.
And he's been brought up in the slums of Paris.
Yes.
And it's basically a death sentence.
Yes.
And he's just going, well, you know, I'll go.
Yeah, so there is a kind of fatalism, isn't it, that you're going to die anyway pretty soon.
And they could have died in World War One in the trenches.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah.
In fact, didn't I say something that I remember writing that about the captain who led the lieutenant who led the assault on Bono, Lieutenant Fontaine.
Yeah.
You know, he was, of course, raised to captain and died fighting in the trenches, you know, within weeks of the start of World War One. Along with
that, and like, I mean, it's an interesting juxtaposition that you make in that book. That, I mean, we sort of, because it happened, we kind of accept all wars, but particularly the First World War.
Yeah.
But you just think sometimes what a fucked up shit that one. And of course, it was all started, of course, as you say, right at the end of the book, by a Brown in 9mm. I know, I just took on 4 seconds.
Actually,
just on the print
I've been to Sarajevo, right, and it's there. It's in the museum.
The 19th. Wow. The gun the Princip used.
Two things we haven't really talked about, like a bank robbery, how it worked back then, like what it looked like, the bank robbery, and then maybe a bit about the police, the guys chasing them as well.
Well, the funny thing is that their first attempt at a bank robbery went horribly wrong because they drew up outside the bank, and I'm sure they chose, the bank was called La Societe Generale, so the bank's name is like General Society. It's like making a statement, isn't it? This is an attack on society. So they drew up outside the bank, and two of the guys jump out, and they, what they do is they go to intercept the bank messenger. Now, in those days, you can imagine this, can't you? The guy's got like a bicorn with sort of tassels and a special sack, and he's got a chain on his wrist and everything, and he's marching along the street. I mean, bit of a giveaway. And he's got, they think he's got 50,000 in cash in his bag, in francs. But in fact, it turns out he's only got 50,000 in bonds,
right,
which of course are almost completely useless. Yeah. They have to try and negotiate them. And young Octave, as I say, the 19-year-old, he just marches towards him and basically grabs the sack and just shoots him. And then they get away, of course. But then they realise, you know, that was useless. They've got all these bonds. So then they have to do another robbery. So this one is better planned. So they steal a car again. And the other thing is they always steal luxury motors. Yeah. I mean, these aren't just any old Henry Ford type
when's
cars.
When's it they stick up a De Dion boot on and the chauffeur pulls his... pulls his own gun.
Yeah. So they shoot him in
so
the chest.
So they shoot him.
Yeah, I know. So
amazing. Extraordinary it's world, crazy. You know. Yeah.
So they seize this sort of luxury car and then sort of drive through the suburbs, and they decide to choose a bank outside Paris. So a small town, a very famous town, Chantilly, where the cream comes from, where the horse racing is. So they draw up right in the main square outside the bank and just jump out straight into the bank, you know, guns over the counter, give us all your money. And there's a bit of hesitation. And the next thing, somebody starts shooting, and then they shoot three bank clerks. Steal all the money into the car. Meanwhile, this other guy's outside. Bono's at the wheel of the car. Andre has got the rifle and he's shooting over people's heads as the crowd approaches. And then they run out, jump in, and they're off. So it's sort of, well, it was almost well executed if they hadn't shot people. Mm. And they get away. But that's their last main robbery, effectively.
Yeah,
and occasionally they run into a policeman who sort of tries to stop them, and they shoot him dead as well. In fact, his namesake Garnier, Octave Garnier, shoots his namesake right outside the main train station in Paris. But it's just like a sort of mad raid.
What? So I mean, it's just a jump. What do you think? I mean, what do you think? What lessons?
Lessons.
Yeah,
now.
We're learning. Old.
God, isn't that we're at the end?
Yeah. Well, no, there's no, you know. This is the Alexis L podcast.
The lessons. Let me think of the lessons.
Comrade, we have a, if we're trying to deduce, you know, this is not just a podcast for entertainment. This is a, you know, podcasters have not just interpreted the world. They should seek to change it. To paraphrase.
Well, the reality is that it was a tragic outcome, wasn't it? The obvious lesson to be learnt is they did it all wrong and they shouldn't have done it. And it was exactly as many anarchists said. It was a complete political dead end, and it should have been stopped. You can't get away from that. That's clear, isn't it?
Yes, they seem like. Do you think they were horrible people? Because in a way,
I think everybody was very different. I think if you look at the way Victor Serge in his book described his friend René as a poet, he was often in the bars, you know, doing poetry, and Raymond was his young friend from a teenage years, but who became obsessed with science as the answer to everything. I mean, Bono was a bitter man, you know, because his lover had been arrested, his best friend had been shot. I think there's no question that the young Octave, who was the main guy with the, he just was happy to shoot his way out of anything. He seems like quite a difficult person to right. work with, mm. I'd say. He had the rows with Victor Serge when they left the commune. He was the one who shot, I think, first on every occasion.
But there are, I mean, there are parallels in terms of methodology with Irish nationalism, Basque nationalism, for instance, isn't there? In terms of the use of violence. You know.
I think that when you've got small illegal groups, it's bound to go horribly wrong, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, one of the criticisms of the whole turn of the Russian Revolution is that all those people had just been involved in conspiratorial politics because you know, any form of open opposition to the Tsar was illegal. So they naturally had to go underground. So the people who rose to the top were people like Stalin. Stalin was one of the great organisers of bank robberies. I mean, that's why Lenin liked him, because he pulled off the great robbery in 1907 in Tbilisi, where they killed how many people? 20 people in the main square robbing the bank. You know,
yes.
I mean, this was enormous. They stole millions, I think, yeah. of rubles. But Lenin loved him because he can organise... Yeah. And absolutely ruthless.
Yeah.
No thought for the casualties. This yeah. was the revolution.
Yeah. I mean, and here, but we see we are learning lessons. Oh, I mean, because here we see a central problem, I think, of trying to build a better world, a socialist world, in that, I mean, all those liberation groups have all become corrupted yeah. and violent. You know, the PLO or, you know, the ANC or, you know, they all... I don't know if you can talk a bit more about that, really. I mean,
well, I think that's true. I think that's
true. I mean, that's a fundamental problem that we wrestle with, I think, is that...
But the main problem, with that's why the idea of the mass strike was an alternative. That was put forward by Rosa Luxemburg 100 years ago. It was an alternative to a Bolshevik seizure of power, for instance.
Right.
To avoid that small conspiratorial sort of elite seizing power. And... Who was it who identified that as a problem? Well, it was Bakunin back in the 19th century as an anarchist, as Marx's main opposition, saying, no, 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 this is all going to go horribly wrong.
Yes.
And he was a Russian. And I mean, I have to say, he didn't avoid conspiratorial politics himself, but at least he saw the dangers of seizing state power in that format. Yeah. So anarcho-syndicalism was meant to be an answer to that problem. And the mass strike and also the ideas of workers' councils, Soviets' councils, and joining, federating them together. You know, those are sort of meant to be solutions to this problem of power.
Yeah. Well, that's what Linda was saying last night, really. The only way she can see is smaller states, I suppose, smaller organisations of people who...
Well,
you know,
federated communes yeah. and federated yeah. organisations.
Yeah.
And every time there is a revolutionary situation, we almost always see... working class people themselves creating their own organs mm. of popular power. So you've had like the assembly movement, for instance, in Spain or South America. You've had Soviets in Russia. All these things arise actually from the people and their own organisations, which tend to be trade union style organisations. Or sometimes, if you go to Solidarity in the 1980s in Poland, you've got neighbourhood associations. You see, that was the effectiveness of Solidarity, where they combined both trade unions, people who belong to a particular trade, with local areas. And if you combine those together, you can get an right. extremely yes. effective general strike going
yeah.
that you can't get with just trade unions.
But then, yes, did they think about, after the strike that, you know, that brought about, you know, the collapse of capitalism, did they think about who was going to run shit after that? Did they think beyond the strike?
Well, I think that was the problem with it. At that period, because they were anti-communist, they'd had to jettison socialist ideas as a whole. So they were therefore open to the Poland. Sorry.
Yeah.
So yes. Even though the forms of organisation had a lot in them, you know, if they'd have kept them as the organs of power, effectively, we'd have had a completely different sort of society arising. But once they'd achieved the sort of overthrow of the communist states, it was just like, yay, capitalism, you know, come on over, yeah. whatever you want. And I think the people were invited, weren't they, to sort of Moscow in the 1990s to you know, from America and Britain and France to discuss ways that they could privatize everything.
Yeah.
And it was like, you need some oligarchs.
Yeah.
And
shock therapy and
Exactly. And really,
and the Chinese didn't go for that.
They didn't. And the Chinese warned the Russians not to do that.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yeah. The Russians went for it. And guess what the result of that was?
Yeah.
Putin.
Yeah.
Putin was the reaction to the seizure of power by the oligarchs.
Yeah.
He represented the group and being
Putin,
left out.
Putin is a... The past seizure of power comes from the advice given by the World Bank, the IMF.
Yeah.
You know.
Putin was in fact... said by, I think, the American ambassador at the time to be the only uncorrupted person in Yeltsin's government. And that they should push forward.
Yeah.
Because he was safe. And, of course, for a long time, he was a safe pair of hands, wasn't he? Didn't object to the NATO attacks on various countries for quite a long time until he
A point that's
changed.
Stated over and over again in the Western media. The BBC do shit, but, you know, the Guardian.
But anyway, we're not not here to discuss Putin, really, but maybe we are.
Well, I think it's all connected, isn't it? You know, I say this is a particularly free-flowing discussion, but I think, for me, it all kind of links up.
It makes me think, how would we ever have some sort of revolutionary action?
Fuck knows.
Without being completely crushed by the military or by the government, being spied on, being...
Well, I don't think that's the problem, actually.
No.
Because I think, you know, it's all about consciousness, isn't it, really? If you get to that stage, you know, the military wouldn't take up arms against the people because they would have already realised that something better awaited them, perhaps, you know, he said.
Sure,
hopefully.
Yeah. Actually.
But I think, no, the wider... The bigger problem is surely is just the complete lack of imagination these days.
Yeah,
I think.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that once you've sort of jettisoned the whole of socialist ideas, you know, it's the end of history or whatever it is, and you know, what are you going to replace it with? The only thing that's been the current replacement is just environmentalism, isn't it? That's the main strand of activism. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's what the kids seem to be.
And let's look now. We've now got green parties potentially like in power in places in Germany or in alliance in the government, aren't they?
Yeah.
And what's their agenda now? Pro-nuclear, pro-war.
Yeah. I mean amazing.
And you voted green and you just think, for what?
It
was always a dead... That was always a dead end.
Yeah.
Single issue without any socialist ideas.
Yes, absolutely. I think identity... Yeah, single issue politics always... plays into the hand of the power, really, because it doesn't look at the totality of, you know, the world, really, and the economic system that oppresses us.
Indeed.
Fuck.
I know.
We're
God, we're fucking hell. In Christ.
And then we'll probably get people like the Bono Gang, you know, people like that saying, it's all fucked, let's just get some guns and go crazy.
I mean, there was an interesting... Eric Hobsbawm, the other Marxist historian, wrote a very interesting book about banditry, really.
That's
I think years ago, which I thought was fascinating because, in a sense, although obviously, as you said, bandits are not politically, Bonnie and Clyde were not politically conscious. They were anti-authoritarian, weren't they? And so they do embody a certain kind of challenge to the...
Well, they arose out of objective conditions, comrade.
Which
was, you know, the terrible poverty that hit the American Midwest in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was, and that's why they were heroes for a lot of people.
Yes.
You know.
But they weren't consciously political. They
weren't consciously political.
But they were
a symptom
and also their actions were political. Everything you do is political. But,
yeah. But you know, it wasn't too long afterwards that the New Deal came in.
Mm.
And that actually dealt with
the
social...
I always
issues.
Wonder, this is nothing to do with anything. What happened to them dust bottles? Are they still there?
Well, or... I was reading about... Because we've
the
had...
What,
a,
the what, sorry?
Well, what happened? The, what caused the...
The dust bowl, yeah.
The dust bowl. What, you know, what the
well,
Steinbeck's great novel, The Grapes of Wrath, is about is that...
Yeah.
Because of inefficient ways of... inefficient ways of farming that the topsoil became eroded and essentially blew away. So all these farmers in Oklahoma and stuff had nothing to farm. And so they had to get in their trucks and move west.
Apparently at the same time, they had huge famines, not just in the Ukraine, but in China and other places as well. There, apparently in the late 20s, 30s, there was a, it seems like there was a climatic problem across that entire latitude. But I'm not really sure. But yeah, I wonder whether
like you those areas, yeah, they're recognized.
Are the dust bowls still in Oklahoma?
Still dusty.
Yeah.
Have a look.
Sorry, we this. Do you want to pull this back to?
I'm not sure how I can. I think the Bono Gang would make a great 6-part series.
Yeah.
Oh mate, I was picturing the movie every page I was turning. I was like, it's so cinematic. And you know, you've got things like Peaky Blinders. You've got this Paris Cops. So like,
yeah, this is Peaky Blinders with politics.
It would be.
Tell you should speak to Ronan Bennett. Do you know Ronan Bennett?
Yeah, Ronan has actually.
He's had a look at what happened.
Yeah, so
difficult. Yeah,
we'll see. Maybe now that Top Boy's finished.
Yeah, he's a writer. He's
done enormously well.
Yeah, but he's also been in Pokey, hasn't he? He's done it.
He has, but he was acquitted actually by on appeal by a Diplock court, which is quite an achievement.
Yeah, because they didn't. That was a court with no juries and anything, just a judge presided, and he was
He was one of the ones, the lucky ones, I suppose, from that system.
It's unusual for a writer, though, to you know, to have actually, you know, done time. There's a few. I was locked up for a night once.
Oh, yeah. For your poetry. For your performance.
The dust bowls in the Sahara dwarf the US dust bowls of the 1930s, but the American ones aren't around anymore. But there are massive ones in Africa.
Yeah, but the ones...
But what happened? Did they just grow grass over them or something? Or did they suddenly turn to pasture?
Regular rainfall returned to the region by 1939, bringing the Dust Bowl years to a close.
That's what you said. It was a climactic shift.
Well, maybe there was a climatic issue at the time.
Yeah.
But nobody. I don't think people starved to death in America, did they? That was the difference.
What do you think?
Wasn't there an Idaho potato famine? Was that a different time?
That was different.
I don't know.
How did we end up on that?
Richard, thank you very much. That was fascinating. I don't know if we've covered a tenth of what you've written or what you...
Well, it's a great story, I think.
Yeah.
Get a book. It's wicked.
Film producers out there, yeah, it would make a great movie.
Mm-hmm. How would you do it? Would you have them speaking in English with French accents, English with English accents?
I must say, I see it as a Franco-German co-production.
Speaking French with subtitles, you can get away with that.
Well, the French know the story. You see, the problem is we don't really know the story.
Right.
So it's got resonance, you know.
Right.
I'll tell you a little story before we finish that. So we did actually, we went to America to see a scriptwriter about this. And we told him the story, and he said, I love it, but where's the happy ending? So he said, we have to have a happy ending. So we just thought, what are we going to do about happy ending? I said, look, everyone, how can you do a happy ending? Everybody got executed or guillotined, and they got killed in shootouts with the cops. Yeah. Where's the happy ending? So, well, extraordinarily, we came across Uli Edel, who's the director of the Baader-Meinhof film, which you may remember was a fantastic film about the Baader-Meinhof game. And so we gave it to him, and he came up with the most fantastic plot with a happy ending. And it was so brilliant. I just thought, it's got to be done.
Yeah.
And it all revolves around, and I've got a picture with me of this guy somewhere. This guy, so I'm holding up a picture of the guy with the most fabulous moustache from 1911. And he's got his collar and his red tie and his nice jacket on, looking every inch the good bourgeois, isn't he? But this is Eugène Dieudonné. Oh, and this is a very interesting story, because this is what extended the whole Bono Gang story through the 20s. He was wrongly accused of shooting the bank messenger, when in fact he'd been shot by this other guy, and everybody knew it. And he ended up sentenced to death, got commuted to life imprisonment on Devil's Island, sent to Devil's Island. He escaped from Devil's Island, and he got a presidential pardon.
Whoa.
There's your happy
ending. And then he ended up Exactly. Then he ended up working with Jean Vigo. He went back to his old job as a furniture maker in one of the faubourgs in Paris. And so there was the happy ending. But he was, of course, one of the original friends of Bono. And it was sort of Bono who sort of recruited him to the cause. But he says he never actually joined in. He was just
never
a friend.
Shot no one, yeah.
I never shot nobody. So Eugene becomes the happy ending. And so the whole story starts with him escaping from Devil's Island. And then we do it as a flashback.
I'd pay.
Isn't that wonderful?
I'd pay my Disney Plus subscription. So,
anyway, I mean,
I'll tell you what. This has got nothing to do with it. I'll tell you what. I always amazed me that nobody's ever done a movie about, and that's John Brown. You're John Brown. And that's a kind of a legalist. Nobody's ever done a movie. I don't think about the John. You know, the raid on
John
the
Brown is amazing. Very interesting character.
Yeah.
I mean, what he did is it's extraordinary. Yeah.
And as links with.
Yeah.
Nobody, I think whether they're too frightened or something, but I mean, if it's an it was an extraordinary act of some, extraordinary.
He got hanged for it, of course, didn't he?
Yeah.
The raid on, I've been to Harper's Ferry.
Really?
Yeah. It's, America, they do amazing. Their historical sites are so well preserved.
Mm.
It's really an eye opener.
Maybe we'll do another edition on Harper. We'll do another edition of John Brown.
I don't know, John Brown.
What
John
about a film about Bakunin?
Body lies a moldering in the
grave. What about Bakunin? Bakunin, the great Russian anarchist. Mm-hmm. He's imprisoned in the Schusselberg. He takes part in 1848 revolutions. He escapes from Siberia, goes around the world through America, comes back, confronts Marx, writes all his pamphlets, engages in insurrection in Italy.
Okay.
There.
Does he have superpowers as well?
If we can play anarchist top trumps.
If he's got a talking monkey. If his mate, his best friend is a talking monkey, I am on board. My production company will.
This is great, but where's the talking monkey?
Where's the talking monkey?
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
That was great. It was really interesting. All right. Well, that was fascinating, and I would love to get Richard back again to talk about further things. As Talal said, after we had an amazing discussion afterwards about China, I think the kind of the Western attacks on China.
He had some nice anecdotes about that, and how China view us.
Yes, that's right. He did, and he'd actually acted for some Chinese money launderers or something. I don't think we okay. We're out of pocket to say that.
But they see us as
kind of dumb. Idiots. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially falling into their TikTok trap that they've set for all our kids. But which is funny because there is that recent clip circulating online at the moment of BBC News, I think, interviewing someone in China. And do you know the clip I mean?
No.
And he's like asking him, do you think England should view China as an adversary, as an enemy? And the Chinese diplomat is saying, no, there's no reason to think that at all. We should be allies. We should be working together. Oh, God, that was those boring cul-de-sac. I'm sorry I mentioned it. But I do have...
Is that it?
That was the whole...
Fucking hell, that was boring. Yeah, go on.
Sorry. I do have something exciting, though. You were bemoaning-ish earlier how we should have more views on our cycling videos and such.
Yep.
But listen, YouTube numbers are not the be all and end all. Don't forget, this is a podcast we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on the verge of 1 million downloads of our podcast. Woo-hoo.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yes.
That's a lot.
That's very much a lot. But I did want to ask you, one of your sketch shows in the 90s, how many views would one episode get?
Oh, a lot more than that.
For one episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we stuff at its peak would get 5 million viewers, you know.
Fuck me.
There and then.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, 5-6 million. But that was a different,
That's different.
That was a different age.
Podcasting is a much more... There were only 4 channels back then.
Yeah, exactly.
Podcasting, you have literally millions to choose from. And
And thank you for choosing us.
I think in the next episode or the episode after, I will be announcing that we have reached 1 million all-time
listeners. Something. That is something.
It's this, really good.
In this world.
I'm so
proud.
So keep it up, listeners. Spread the word. Tell your friends.
Let's go on to the second million.
Yeah. And I did film our interview with Richard Parry with our new camera.
Yeah.
So I will try and put some fun clips up on the social media and maybe some stuff for the Patreon. I don't know if you saw it, actually, you wouldn't have because you don't have Instagram, Alexi. But I did put a cool edit of, I made like a minute and a half version of our assembly of our bikes.
All right.
And put it on Instagram. And I'm pretty chuffed with what I did with it.
Mm-hmm.
So follow us on Instagram at AlexiSailPod. And please go to patreon.com/AlexiSailPod because AlexiSailPodcast. And help fund things like these new cameras and my time editing and producing this.
Yeah.
It would mean a great deal. But yeah, 1 million listeners, air horn, party poppers, all that stuff.
All right.
We're nearly there.
All right, cool. All right, well, thank you. That was the XL podcast number 39. Onwards to number 40. Bye-bye.
Woo!
You've been listening to the AlexiSail podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.